If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Everybody, it's Ryan Ballengee. Welcome to a special edition, I suppose, of the 19th Hole Golf Show. This is a podcast that kind of came up out of nowhere. If you want to call it an emergency pod, I don't know if it's an emergency. We don't have to do this. But it is a pod that's kind of a reaction podcast, and I have not typically done this. I don't typically do this, and I probably won't ever do this. Well, I won't say I'll never do it again, but I probably won't do it much more often than this. And the reason I'm doing this is to try to do a response of some sort to the release of a ranking system created by Sports Illustrated, sponsored by LA Golf, and created in consultation with a company called Golf Intelligence. And this ranking system is designed ostensibly to offer a more inclusive version of a world ranking that allows live golfers to be ranked, and that offers some differences with the official World Golf Ranking in an attempt to identify the best players in the world. And I got the notification, email, what have you about it this morning. And then I kind of dug in on it. And sure enough, by the time I had read through it, Golf Twitter was already torching the thing. And I hadn't really had an opportunity to look through it all yet. So I wanted to take the opportunity to do that myself before I kind of made some conclusions about it, made some thoughts about it available. And sure enough, I kind of have come to that conclusion as well. I have some pretty significant issues with this ranking system, and I kind of wanted to detail them here in a podcast format instead of writing what might turn out to be a rambling 2,000 or 3,000 words about a ranking system, and it might just be easier to hear it broken down piece by piece going through it verbally. So I've made a whole lot of notes based on what I've read and what I've consumed of the Sports Illustrated ranking, and then we'll kind of go through all of it piece by piece and try to reach what amounts to a conclusion and give you an idea of why I think that this is not a very good ranking system. Now, let's start at the top. First, this is presented by Sports Illustrated, and it is done in consultation with a company called Golf Intelligence, and the sponsor for it is LA Golf. So I am naturally a cynical person. I am always looking for the self-interest in these types of things, and we have to address those, of course. Anytime you create a world ranking system, you're obviously trying to promote yourself just as much as the system, right? This is something to get people talking. And obviously, in that regard, it has succeeded. People are talking about it. Even if you might not like what they have produced, you're talking about it. If you go onto the website and you click through the link to see the ranking system, you're giving them traffic. If you check out their calculations, you're giving them traffic. You're giving them oxygen. And that is something to be expected when something like this comes out. And obviously, they want it to be taken seriously. So it's something you come back to week after week and you check out. And you see where the movement is, and if you're one of those folks who are a live golf fan, you go, hooray, you know, our live golf rankers aren't just falling down the ranking system like they do the official World Golf Ranking every week, and we'll come back to that point in a little while, but that's an appeal to those folks. And so you have to know kind of some of the business interests involved in the ranking, and then you can take or leave it somewhat based on that, or you can just kind of move on. But I think you have to acknowledge those things regardless. So what are some of the interests involved here? Well, one of the brands involved here is Sports Illustrated, as we mentioned. And Sports Illustrated is part of the Arena Group and is a brand managed under a company called the Authentic Brands Group. And they have a portfolio of a lot of different brands. Just kind of scrolling here, we're looking in the neighborhood of close to 50 brands that Authentic Brands Group manages. Well, it just so happens that three of those brands are Sports Illustrated brands. One, the swimsuit issue, one Sports Illustrated for kids, and the other Sports Illustrated itself. Now, that unto itself isn't necessarily interesting, but the other kind of caveat to this is that Greg Norman's brand is also managed under the same Authentic Brands group. And there are other brands too, by the way. Izod is a golf brand that's covered under this. The Elvis Presley brand, Brooks Brothers, Aeropostale, Airwalk. Remember those from the 90s? Eddie Bauer. So they own a lot of brands. Shaquille O'Neal, a lot of brands that are related to this company. So you have to know that up front, right? There is a business relationship there, however indirect it might seem. But there is one between Greg Norman, who is the CEO and commissioner of LIV Golf, and Authentic Brands Group, vis-a-vis SI. So we know that. Now, LA Golf is the sponsor of this ranking. LA Golf has a vested interest in this ranking system because two of their player partners are Dustin Johnson and Bryson DeChambeau, two guys whose world ranking has plummeted in the OWGR because of their involvement with LIV. LIV events do not get any official world golf ranking points, as you probably well know if you're listening to this. And so both of these guys have fallen precipitously, and I would say not in truth relative to their talent level, although Bryson has struggled mightily. But Dustin obviously played very well in the LIV Golf Invitational Series. Whatever you think of the value of that, he did play very well, and I still think is a very relevant professional golfer. So for him to suddenly be outside the top 50 in the world in the official world golf ranking doesn't necessarily suit the business interests of LA Golf. Same for Bryson DeChambeau. And so if you have a ranking system that includes LIV players and includes two of the best known LIV players, then there's a stand to benefit there from LA Golf by being able to tout, hey, in the SI World Golf Ranking, Dustin Johnson is not outside the top 50 in the world. And he's actually in a decent spot in the ranking. So if you look at what they have produced, and we'll get to that in a second, then you can see some value there for LA Golf in having Dustin Johnson come in at number 13 in their ranking. And then, you know, yes, it means something, right? To have players like under their banner in the ranking system. And I'm not saying that is the sole reason for doing this whatsoever, but that is something that you actually have to acknowledge before you kind of look at an entire system, right? You have to know what's going into it. What are the inputs? So those are the business inputs. Now, what are the formula inputs? The formula inputs are significantly different than the official World Golf Ranking. So the first big input difference is that the ranking range for their ranking, the SI ranking, is 12 months instead of 24 months, a rolling 24 months for the official World Golf Ranking. It's a rolling 12 months for this SI ranking. And then you have to acknowledge that some of the points allocation is a little bit different. So the points allocation done via the official World Golf Ranking is kind of a standard formula. It's similar to how prize money is allocated, but not exactly the same. It's its own thing. And SI has come up with its own allocation system. And that allocation system awards points, 17 and a half points from a field ranking to the winner. And so that's actually different than the way money is allocated on the PGA Tour, DP World Tour, and LIV. So for LIV, they allocate 16% of the purse to the winner because $4 million goes to the winner of a $25 million event. Then you've got the PGA Tour, which gives, in most events, not all, there are some that are different, but 18% to the winner. And then on the DP World Tour, there's 17% that goes to the winner. So the allocation system looked to try to meet some things in the middle, and maybe we'll come back to that a little bit later. But the obvious thing here in creating a 12-month window is that you can bring LIV into this and rank events, and they did so retroactively. They ranked events from the Invitational Series in 2022. They did that retroactively and included them here in the ranking. And that obviously gives the opportunity for LIV events to count without causing some dramatic problem for the ranking scale, right? Because if you did it over an 18-month period, that might negatively affect the ranking, because then you wouldn't have players competing exactly the same, and you wouldn't have, I mean, you had 8 Invitational Series events, and people came in at different times, but there's some skepticism to that, right, of the reason for having a 12-month time period. But what I would say isn't necessarily my issue about trying to include LIV golfers. I mean, that's part of it. But the other part of it is that 12 months is simply not enough time to include or to properly evaluate a professional golfer's resume. And we'll come back to that a little bit later. But that's one of the glaring kind of issues that come up here. This system also awards points based on performance in a tournament. If there is a tournament with a cut, then every player who makes the cut earns points. In no cut events, that means they offer 75% of the field points. So in a LIV golf event, if you're looking at a 48 player field and you're taking 75% of them, that means 36 players get points every time out, which means the bottom 12 don't. However, if you look at the PGA Tour or the DP World Tour, they have a top 65 and ties. So you're trying to create a scenario where you're offering points for playing in a shorter event with fewer players. And I think that you can't just inherently assign 36 players points because of that. And I don't know what the right number is, by the way. I don't know if it's less or more. That you obviously have to kind of put a line in the sand if you're trying to do this way. But if you're offering points to players through the cut-making process, so that can mean 65 players make it, that can mean 75 players make it, that can mean 80 players make it, and oh, by the way, while the PGA Tour has eliminated the Rule 78, where if 78 players make the cut, there's a third round cut, that has not happened on the DP World Tour. So there could be players who can conceptually lose their opportunity to score points in this ranking because of a third round cut, even though there is no cut in any LIV event. That is something kind of difficult to account for, and I admit as much. This was their answer to that. And then they decide to create a computation around ranking events based on criteria that is not exactly the same as the official World Golf Ranking. So the official World Golf Ranking system used to be, before last summer, late last summer, that the strength of field of an event was determined based upon that the players' rankings that contributed to a field strength. And you had to be a top 200 player to contribute to a ranking. And the scale of what points you contributed as a player to the field ranking was weighted basically on where you were in the world ranking. Number one gave you a whole lot of points, number two a little bit less, and kind of individual numbers down into what, the top 15 range or so, and then kind of ranges of 5 to 10 players all the way down to the top 200. Now that's not the case. And the ranking is based on, for strength of field, the total sum of strokes gained world ranking. So that's what players add. And every player in a field adds something, and that may not be much, but it adds something to the ranking. Being a body in the ranking matters, whereas it used to not. You could have been outside the top 200 in the world, and as far as the official World Golf Ranking was concerned, you were a ghost. And it didn't matter that you played in the tournament. Even if you did well, it didn't matter, because you didn't add to the strength of field. That's not the case anymore. Every player adds something to the official World Golf Ranking strength of field measure. That's actually kind of muddled up in the SI World Golf Ranking explanation, because they say performance points are calculated and slanted to the top 100 players in the world. Once you're not in the top 100, your performance points are insignificant to the strength of field calculation. I would greatly beg to differ with that, because that's one of the big differences here, and that's why limited field events are substantially hampered by the new system, because bodies matter. They add something, and so having more bodies means more points. It just does. So I trying to create a points allocation and a strength of field allocation based on two vastly different tournament setups is difficult to do. I recognize that, but it's a little untrue what they're saying here about how the OWGR calculates that. So how does this ranking system account for the strength of field? And what they have decided to do is take away the notion of strokes gained. And the reason they are trying to take away the notion of strokes gained is this idea that not every tour calculates strokes gained, which in and of itself is one of my largest problems with this ranking scale. Because strokes gained is available to everybody. It is very simple. You may not have on every tour strokes gained broken down by the categories the PGA Tour uses, putting, tee to green, which then breaks down into off the tee approach and around the green. But you do have strokes gained total. And there is a disparity, by the way, many times between the added up numbers of all of those categories and the strokes gained total calculation, which is a very simple number. That number is how you do against the field average in every round. Add them all up, divide by the number of rounds, that's the average number of strokes gained that you get. If you just add them all up, that's the total number of strokes gained for a tournament. Every tour can do that. Every event can do that. There is no need for a separate distance per shot calculation. But to give you an idea of what distance per shot is, they call it a simplified version of strokes gained, which is the distance played divided by total score. So let's say, for example, you played a 7,400-yard golf course, which RIV is more or less, and you divided it by 71. So that means you would have a distance per shot number of 104, just to kind of give you the calculation there. There's a real serious problem with this notion, though. And a lot of it has to do with the idea that distance tells you really anything or really everything you need to know about a player's ability and a golf course and the challenge that it presents, right? There are a variety of golf courses on the PGA Tour. They range in length from just under 7,000 yards, like 6,900 yards, to in the area of 7,800 yards. And then if you want to go out even more in the PGA Tour umbrella, you have like TPC Colorado that plays like 8,000 yards, but it's also at elevation, so it doesn't really, so it's like a 7,200-yard course, and elevation is not a factor here, right? Elevation doesn't matter. That's one problem. Two, a golf course's difficulty is way more than distance, because distance doesn't tell you a whole lot. What are you hitting to at distance? Where is the bunker? Where is a hazard? Where is out of bounds? Where are trees? How wide is the fairway? What kind of angle are we looking for? What kind of shot type are we looking for? How big are the greens that you're hitting to? How firm are the fairways? How receptive are they? All of those things and so much more are not captured by distance per shot. And to go back to something we talked to at the beginning of the podcast, why is distance per shot being used? It really isn't, and it cannot be. I do not accept the explanation that it's because it's just not that every tour calculates strokes gained. Everybody can calculate stroke gained. It's not hard. You can do it. Between what professional tours that can do it with just a basic calculation, you can have kind of relative to peer strokes gained, or even the personal level. I mean, there's all kinds of great shot tracker platforms out there, ShotScope among them. Obviously, you've got Arcos out there. I mean, there's a bunch. They even calculate strokes gained for players based on their skill level or handicap range. So that's not true. There's nothing true about that. So why is this happening? Well, if you look at Golf Intelligence and you look at what they do as a business, what does Golf Intelligence do? Well, they are, as they say, a one-stop shop for the direct integration of golf course data, GPS data, 3D green slope data, scoring data, and private label app production, which means the stuff that they do is mapping golf courses. They know what slopes look like, they have topography maps, all that kind of stuff. So what they're trying to use is their own data and their own expertise and shoehorn some relevance for that data into it by trying to make golf course distance matter. It doesn't. It really doesn't. And I think we learn something about that every year, really. But if you learned about it from, let's say, the 2013 U.S. Open at Marion. You learn about it from when you see what Pebble Beach can play like when it's really windy. You see it from how golfers can torch really long golf courses just the same. Think about Detroit Golf Club. It's 7,400 yards. It gets murdered every year in the Rocket Mortgage Classic relative to par. So distance per shot is not an acceptable metric. It doesn't make any sense. Further, the problem of distance per shot is only amplified by the fact that they basically use a system similar to the World Handicap System, and they value a player based on their top 40% of their scores that they have over this 12-month period. There are a max of 40 scores that can be used, and the top 16 are used for a player. You need a minimum of 20, so that's your minimum divisor, so to speak. But if you take 40% of 20, that's 8, so your best 8 scores count. Well, that also doesn't make sense for a variety of reasons. One of them is that players play different schedules, right? And so, and this is really the biggest reason, but it evolves into several separate reasons. So every player plays a different schedule, right? Every player has different events that they favor, even in the era of designated tournaments and PIP guys playing 17 specific tournaments for which they are eligible together, and then 3 separate tournaments. But then compare someone like, we're going to say John Rahm here. John Rahm plays difficult golf courses, right? And so he has a different standard to beat. He also probably typically plays longer golf courses, although it's not inherently true, but he typically plays longer golf courses because the major championships tend to be a little bit longer than the others. Again, not inherently true, but that could be the case. So he plays a very different set of schedule with the average course length quite different. He might play more par 70s because majors are often par 70. Not necessarily par 72, particularly the U.S. Open. A lot of players who might play another schedule are par 72. So distance relative to par also would mean something, and that's not calculated here. Then you're taking the best of a player's resume, the best 40% of those scores. Well, if you're a player who competes regularly on longer golf courses, then you stand to gain an advantage, right? If you are a longer hitter and you play well on fairly wide, fairly easy golf courses that are longer, again, I'm thinking TPC Twin Cities, I'm thinking Detroit Golf Club, other tournaments can come to mind, but we don't have to go through the entire list here. But basically, if you're playing longer golf courses and scoring pretty well, then those are your best scores, right? But you're also playing tougher courses, and the distance may be shorter, because think about the country club for the U.S. Open. Wasn't all that long, still quite difficult. So the distance per shot thing doesn't really work. Strokes gained was just fine, and they muddled that up. And I don't understand the reason for that, other than the fact that this is Golf Intelligence's business, is distance and topography, and so they wanted to kind of use that instead. Now, they also have what they're calling a course adjustment. So they're using distance per shot as a course adjustment. They say a course adjustment is calculated using AI and high fidelity player and course data. Their example, if course A averages a distance per shot of 100 and course B has an average DPS of 105, then it is easy to see the stroke differential between course A and course B. Of course, that is patently false. That is not true. Nothing bears that out. It's just not the case. I'm sorry. It's just not. But they say, for pro golfers, we will compare the DPS numbers from each course they play and rank them accordingly. We will apply the adjustment prior to determining their DPS ranking, which will determine the strength of field. For amateur golfers, we will use the same formula for each skill level and calculate an adjustment before the score is used for their DPS ranking value. We will use 40% of the 40 latest scores, and a golfer needs 20 minimum scores to be considered current and relevant. Again, distance per shot just doesn't make sense. It doesn't. I'm sorry. That's probably my biggest issue with all of this, because it totally ignores the realities of golf course architecture, the realities of playing golf between weather, firmness, time of day, and they do try to address time of day later in the ranking, I will note, although that's not really currently in the system. They may attempt to address it or incorporate it later, but distance per shot is not the metric we want. It's not even close, and it frankly is close to disqualifying the entire ranking on that point, but that's what they've come up with. So that's what they're going to use. So when they're trying to evaluate a strength of field for a tournament, they have basically two metrics. They have a if-then statement. So if top 100 players are competing, they're the only ones that are relevant to a strength of field. If you're not in the top 100, you do not matter to their ranking. That doesn't really work, given the official World Golf Ranking change that I think a lot of people seem to like, that beating players matters. It does matter to have to beat somebody. It doesn't matter who they are to a degree. They are a body. You have to beat them. That is what we have kind of come up with in the official World Golf Ranking. And I think that is accurate. You do have to matter somewhat. It could be next to nothing, but you do have to matter. So for their ranking system, they have greatly flattened what players can mean to the strength of field. Top 25 players all get 9 points, essentially insinuating that top 25 players are all about the same guy. Well, if you look at the official World Golf Ranking these days, and again, obviously there's a contrast here, but if you look at the current ranking, the official World Golf Ranking, the average points at the top of the ranking is Jon Rahm at 9.5, which is a tremendously high number. And Scottie Scheffler is second at 9, Rory McIlroy is third at 8.4. If you go down to the 25th ranked player in the world, Tyrrell Hatton right now, he averages 2.7555 points per tournament. That gap is enormous. That is 7 points, effectively, between the top-ranked player and the bottom. Now, if you wanted to go farther, you can't. You can't. So you're trying to tell me that there is a similar contribution from 1 through 25. I just can't buy that. I'm sorry, can't. And it also creates a situation for Korn Ferry Tour players and DP World Tour players where they are diminished greatly too, because they currently don't have those kinds of players. Most players in the DP World Tour are not in the top 100 in the world, and so they have to contribute something, but they just don't get as much. And that's why the official World Golf Ranking was corrected to not create a baseline of points that every tournament got for every tour, regardless of how weak the field was. It got rid of the minimum number of points. There was the reason for that. This creates a bigger problem, even than that, for the Korn Ferry Tour and the DP World Tour, because basically none of their players contribute to a strength of field rating. Players ranked 26th through 50th are worth 6 points. Players 51st through 100 in the ranking are worth 3 points to the strength of field. That benefits LIV quite substantially. That's just kind of how it works, right? If you create a system where you have guys in the top 100 and they're relevant to points, and a lot of them are in there, they rack up points. Well, if you don't have anybody on the Korn Ferry Tour or the DP World Tour that's in those measures of the ranking, they're basically never going to get points. That doesn't work particularly well, in my opinion. The second part of that is that distance per shot will be used for strength of field when there are no players in the top 100 in the field. So this is their way to try to get around the realities of the Korn Ferry Tour and the DP World Tour. They say the SI World Golf Ranking will use the top 50 current DPS values in the field to determine strength of field. The DPS strength of field will use a table to determine points available for an event. So if the average DPS of the top 50 players is 105, then they get a ranking point for the event of 10. If it goes all the way down to 95, for example, it's 4. I don't really see the value, again, in shoehorning DPS in here when you could just simply say if you are a player that contributes to the ranking in any fashion, if you're ranked, let's say in the top 500, let's just create that number, 400, 500, you contribute. It would have been a lot more accurate of a system, and it would make more sense. Now, then they throw everything together and say, Golf Intelligence will continue to collect and refine calculations and will use AI, which we don't need to throw around the term AI. We don't need that. We can just say we use computers. It's not any more impressive because we say AI. Nevertheless, they say Golf Intelligence has detailed data on every golf course. Again, explaining the reason to include it. This is their business. And we'll use that combined with player data to hone and improve our ranking on a continuous basis. Golf Intelligence has mapped every golf course in the world and measured each feature of every hole. Again, doesn't matter. It has nothing to do, apparently, with the ranking because all of it is based on distance per shot. So the features don't matter, even though they've mapped them. Green size doesn't matter, wind, average temperature, time of day, cut of grass, architecture. I mean, none of that weighs in. So you're going to have to add that to make it relevant if you're going to do this calculation that's not just simply strokes gained. And so they say, okay, well, we're going to take this data and eventually we're going to collect and analyze situational data and answer some questions about how players perform in the morning or windy days or wet days or strong field, weak field. Well, as it turns out, we have all that stuff. DataGolf does that. Do a really good job. DataGolf is fantastic. I may not agree with everything they think about golf, but they do a great job of data collection and presentation. And that unto itself answers that question. They do it time and time again. They're really good at it. Now, the other issues here are how does a player do with a strong field versus a weak field? Well, DataGolf and Golf News Net have very similar views on how to modify strokes gained to account for competition. Our version is called quality strokes gained. I believe theirs, slightly different, is called true strokes gained. And basically, you're accounting for the quality of your competition as a multiplier of your strokes gained. Sometimes that is a negative multiplier in that if you play against a weaker field, your strokes gained don't mean as much. If you're playing against a stronger field, your strokes gained mean more. And over the 3 years that I have done a weekly model for PGA Tour events, that strokes gained, that quality strokes gained calculation has proven absolutely crucial in identifying winners. Because the best players play the best against really everybody, but particularly against stronger competition. And as something worth noting, my ranking is weaker and not as good, although it is still quite good, against weaker field events because trying to weight competition that is weaker is more difficult to do. It creates a lot more random outcomes. And so you're not necessarily for this week's Honda Classic going to have the winner in the top 11 as I've had pretty much every week going back a calendar year. So that is difficult to do. But we have ways of identifying that using strokes gained and the existing ranking system as a proxy for determining whether strokes gained mean more, the same, or less relative to a standard field. And we don't need to know about the golf course. The strokes gained tell us about that because that's course average. So we know whether a golf course is hard or not, regardless of par, regardless of distance, regardless of architectural features, regardless of time of day. We know all of that stuff because we have data about how the players themselves perform. And then we use that data to determine whether a golf course is difficult or not. And you can line them up by course average. It doesn't really matter what par is. You know what the toughest courses are because of how they are set up, how they are scored against, and then you can multiply that based on the quality of field. So everything to me screams something that was designed to create a system that did a couple of things. One, helped Golf Intelligence kind of use its bread and butter to create a ranking system. Two, to include LIV golfers and do so without a tremendous penalty to them. And then three, just create something people talk about, right? I mean, we're doing this podcast, give some oxygen to that, and try to come up with an earnest criticism of the system. But I think at the end of the day, it doesn't really land well, and it doesn't land particularly accurately. Now, of course, we've got a ranking system. We got their first pass at this, and it's not going to look all that different than the official World Golf Ranking. John Rahm 1, Scottie Scheffler 2, Rory McIlroy 3, Will Zalatoris 4, Patrick Cantlay 5, Cam Smith 6, which, you know, it's fine. He's probably in that range. Max Homa 7, Xander Schauffele 8, Justin Thomas 9, Tony Finau 10, Colin Morikawa 11, and then Matt Fitzpatrick 12, Dustin Johnson 13. And then you just kind of start to go down the line and identify players that are otherwise in the ranking system. So you've got Joaquin Niemann at 21 is the next highest ranked LIV guy after Cam Smith and Dustin Johnson. And then you go down the list a little bit more and you see your next guy in LIV is Anirban Lahiri at 42. No. I mean, I just have a difficult time identifying Lahiri as the 42nd best player in the world when he is 99 in the official World Golf Ranking. Again, longer term trends tell you better stuff about a player's makeup than 12 months. And part of the 12-month problem is not only that it's kind of too short to identify a player's career arc, but there are wild swings that can happen in 12 months that artificially inflate a player's ranking. And so that gets proven out over time, over a 2-year period. You could say an 18-month period actually makes a little bit more sense. I could argue that. I think you can make sense for that. And the reason being for that is not only just a longer time period, but also the nature of the golf schedule. Because then you're not just dealing with one calendar year at a time that turns over, because from year to year, things can change, right? And also there are different times of year where certain players may play more frequently. And I think about different tours. So you have the PGA Tour, which is going to moving forward after this year, really a January through August schedule. So they've got 8 months of the year where they're really doing stuff. Well, some of those players aren't going to compete much at all in September through December. Well, in a 12-month ranking period, they're not really earning any points. And the same thing can be really true over a 24-month period, but the points deprecate less, and so they kind of spread out a little bit more over time. And that kind of works itself out. Then you also have the DP World Tour, where they have a very kind of bell system for their most prestigious events. I guess a 3-point system, because you've got the beginning of the year, the UAE events do well in terms of field ranking. Then you've got some events in the middle, which are now co-sanctioned. So you got like the Scottish Open. You've moved some of your better events to the fall, though, because you've moved the BMW PGA Championship to September. The Irish Open is going to be pretty good this year. Then you've got your closing events, which lead to the end of the race to Dubai. So you've got usually a pretty good field in South Africa for the Sun City event. And you've got a good field in Dubai to end the year, in a 50-person field, by the way, for the DP World Tour Championship. So you have kind of 3 points in the year where those players can earn a lot of points, and the rest of the year they don't really earn much at all. So that creates a very strange kind of nature to it. And then you've got LIV, and LIV is spaced out very strangely because LIV starts this week and they go to November. So their season is, right now at least, and who knows what it could be moving forward, but let's say this year you've got February through November. So you've got a 9-month season, but you've got more time to earn the points. You've got more spaced out nature to it. You've got fewer tournaments, so they may actually be subject to a minimum divisor, so to speak, in this case, because you need 20 scores, right? You need 20 relevant scores. But they also could benefit from potentially playing less. And we also don't really know the makeup of all of their courses yet, but at least from what I've seen so far, many of them are longer, quite long, actually. I mean, think about the International. That's a long golf course. Not on the schedule this year, but it was in 2022. That's a long golf course. Mayakoba is fairly long, longer golf course. There are golf courses on the schedule that they could benefit from that distance per shot calculation. So there are some things that I have difficulty with in the 12-month time period. 18-month probably would have worked out a little bit better. But the real big thing, the big headline thing to me is the distance per shot calculation. It just doesn't work. It is an unserious calculation, in my opinion. And for that to have such a large factor in determining the ranking and determining strength of field just kind of puts it out with the bathwater for me. Because you need something better, more tangible, that gives you an idea about how difficult a golf course is. Distance alone does not do that. And trying to rate players based on the types of courses that they play also doesn't help either, because everyone's playing the same golf course each week, but they're not playing the same golf courses week to week because of the nature of the PGA Tour having 47 events on the calendar. So I don't like that. And then that factors into rating top 100 players in the field. Well, I mean, if you look at the realities of it, LIV and the PGA Tour are the only ones with top 100 players right now. I'm not saying, I mean, there's Adrian Meronk, there's Ryan Fox, there's other guys. Sepp Straka plays some DP World Tour. You've got Tommy Fleetwood, you've got Shane Lowry, you occasionally occasionally contribute. But by and large, if you look at the top 100 in the world, there aren't a whole lot of guys that are playing on the DP World Tour that contribute. So that creates an issue for me. I just think that's a problem. I actually think it's also a problem for the Asian Tour too, but that's a whole other thing entirely. So at the end of the day, I think this thing kind of falls flat on its face, and I would like to see something, I don't know, more refined. It just needs to be more refined. I think this one missed, and it's a 40-minute explanation of why I think it missed, but I think this was worthwhile to go through the exercise of how I think about ranking golfers and what we do with our formula at Golf News Net, admittedly limited to the PGA Tour, but trying to think about how you appreciate golfers and rank golfers. I tend to do that based on long-term performance, not short-term performance, and the evaluation of talent from a betting perspective over the last 3 years of doing this model has borne out that longer-term and medium-term, 1 and 2 year performance, is a proper measure combined, so maybe even 18 months, a way of measuring golfers. And strokes gained actually does the job, because that is really the fundamental basis of everything that we do with the ranking. It does its job. It's good. And it creates a more even understanding of how golf courses play without trying to factor in or take out a whole lot of factors that contribute to scoring like distance per shot does. All right, that's going to do it for us today on this rare, very rare emergency podcast. Thank you for listening to it. If you did, I appreciate it. Love to hear your feedback on it, because you may have a completely different view on this than I do, but I wanted to kind of go through where I came down on this and offer my explanation for why, and then go for it from there. If you have any questions, feedback, I'm on Twitter. You can find me easily. I'm at Ryan Ballingy, or you want to email me, do out of public view, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. Happy to talk about it there as well. Thanks so much for listening. We will talk to you next time on the 19th Hole Golf Show.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key, and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.